always knew I was doing the right thing. Because you have a steadiness about you. And I believe in you. But it comes home, and you must be smarter than your enemy.
What are you trying to say?
The Americans, they're very smart, but sometimes they can be incredibly stupid. They spend all this money and time and energy on the so-called war on terror. They put satellites up in space. They can ram a smart bomb up a camel's ass from a situation room 5,000 miles away. But every time the U.S. kills an Al-Qaeda leader, what happens? There's a new one before the body's cold. You do it a million times, and they never get it because the real solution always eludes them.
What is?
Do nothing.
Nothing.
Nada. If you want to shut down a fundamentally flawed system, all you gotta do is step out of its way, and it'll shut itself down. Nature has a way of correcting itself.
Yeah, boys and girls, just step out of its way. Don't jump in its way like the right wing or the conservatives do. Jump out of its way. When it's this corrupt and this far down the tube, let it fall. Let it fall. Hey, this is Terrible Tommy in the bunker right here in north central Indiana on a overcast and cool day. It was in the 30s this morning. That's a little too cold for me. But I'm sure we got more to come. And, okay, we're at P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana, 46581. That's where you send all your moolah, your shekels, your greenbacks, and we'll make sure to put them in the right place, okay? And you can call us at 559-670-1473. Free. How about that? And then go up to resist.com and you can dig into our archives, their radio shows, where we have hundreds of shows and all kinds of books and everything you can download and get a college education. You can get better than a Harvard degree on race and politics and other things that affect the white race. Now today we're going to go back into the book or the magazine State Secrets that we used to get out of the International Anti-Communist Organization, and their headquarters was in Guadalajara, Mexico. How about that? And they give you quite a bit of information on history and Jews and people like that, and crooked white people too. So let's get into it, and this is entitled Versailles to the World War II. Okay. Jewish power, which had been exercised secretly as regards to Palestine, became more visible in the course of the peace negotiations which followed the defeat of Germany in the First World War. On 28th to 30th of June 1917, a great international Masonic conference was held at the headquarters of the Grand Orient in Paris, an ultra-secret meeting of absolutely vital historic significance at which nearly every Allied and neutral lodge was present, represented. The object of this reunion was to lay the foundations of a peace treaty, to compare the creation of the future League of Nations, and to set out the general principles governing the new society which was to emerge after the war. A commission was formed, and as a result, the Labour's brother Libby read out a resolution comprising 13 articles, which was to become a charter of the international Masonic doctrine. 6 months later, Brother Wilson, the President of the United States, supported by Brother House, that's Mandel House, and his faithful Jewish advisors, Baruch and Brandeis, set out before the whole world his famous 14 points, 13 of which were taken in their entirety from the Masonic Congress of Paris in June 1917. This fact may be unknown to the general public, but it is nevertheless indisputably true. We will now reproduce several typical passages from the Congress, taken from the book which I devoted to the whole subject in 1936. Quote, "This war," said Brother Carnot, president of the Grand Orient of France, in his opening speech, which was unleashed by the military autocracies, "has become a formidable quarrel in which the democracies have organized themselves against the military powers. The Great War of 1914, which was inflicted first on France, Belgium, and Russia, then on Europe, and finally upon the whole world by German aggression, has itself gradually and continually brought into definition the character of this struggle, which is of the British Empire, and finally conclude a deal with the latter of reciprocal basis. Thus, the secret history of America's entry into the war in 1917 on the side of the Allies is revealed in as secret history of the creation of the Jewish national home in Palestine. And both these events, it cannot be disputed, are of the utmost importance if one is to understand the evolution of the modern world. Finally, it is a measure of the value of the press, which is supposed to be a source of objective information, and which is so avid for sensational news that for 30 years it has maintained a total blackout on a document of absolutely capital importance, so that not so much as a whisper alluded to its existence has been made in the numerous histories of the First World War. Doubtless, looking back, we may have reason to thank the Jews for pushing America into the war on our side in 1917, but in 1917 it was simply fortuitous that their interests coincided with those of the Allies. Today, in 1975, it is not so reassuring to learn that America's foreign policy is in the hands of a Jewish Zionist of German extraction, Dr. Henry Kissinger, the man who was first of all President Nixon's private advisor, who was then promoted to Secretary of State. Well, we have a little problem here. I see that one page is missing out of this manuscript. Page 18, if I ever find it, I'll read it to you. We're going to have to start it with 19. From the violation of the Belgium neutrality to the rising of the USA, and not excluding the Russian Revolution, there is not one fact which cannot be brought forward as a proof of this gigantic duel between two hostile groups. Incidentally, it is noteworthy that the communist writer H. Barbusi wrote in La Humanite on 9th August 1914, quote, "This is a social war which will witness a big step forward, perhaps the final one, in our cause. It is being waged against our everlasting enemies, militarism and imperialism, the sword and the book, and, I should add, the crown." Not long after the war, Mr. Coolidge, President of the United States, publicly stated in a speech at Hammond, Indiana, in 1927, "The chief question at stake in this formidable conflict was to decide which form of government was to predominate among the great nations of the world, the autocratic form or the republican form. Victory finally remained on the side of the people." Thus, the First World War, which commenced as a national war, was transformed by Freemasonry into a social war, but it was also a holy war. If ever there was a holy war, this is it, and we should never forget it. However, Freemasonry goes further than this and uses victory in order to establish a new order in the world based upon the principles of the First Revolution of 1789. It is the duty of Freemasonry at the close of the cruel drama now being played out to make its way and humanitarian voice heard and to guide the nations towards a general organization which will become their safeguard. Brother Mioni of Italy declared that the future of humanity must be established on the absolutely new foundations. Freemasonry is also revealed as the instrument which created the League of Nations and which in turn became the very objective of the whole war. The minutes of the early meeting at which preparations for the Congress in June were put in hand state, "The objective of this Congress will be to investigate the means of elaborating the Constitution of the League of Nations." At the Congress itself, Brother Cuneau stated, "Freemasonry, which labors for peace, intends to study this new organism, the League of Nations. Freemasonry will be the propaganda agent of this conception of universal peace and happiness. The League of Nations is the whole object of the war. The whole world realizes that a peace, which was simply an instrument of diplomacy, would be incomplete, and that it should represent the first step towards the League of Nations. Finally, President Wilson is openly acclaimed as the agent of Freemasonry in his work. On page 117 of my work, La Société des Nations, I quote the resolution which Congress addressed to him, quote, "This Congress sends to Mr. Wilson, President of the United States, the homage of its admiration and tribute to of its recognition of the great services he has rendered humanity, declares that it is happy to collaborate with President Wilson in his work of international justice and democratic fraternity, which is Freemasonry's own ideal, and affirms that the eternal principle of Freemasonry are completely in harmony with those proclaimed by President Wilson for the defense of civilization and liberty of peoples." Brother Libby's communication to the consul of the order on December 9, 1917 effectively sums up the whole situation. It is a question of knowing what is right, good faith or lies, good or evil, liberty or autocracy. The present conflict is the continuation of that which began in 1789, and one of these two principles must triumph or die. The very life of the world is at stake. Can humanity live in freedom? Is it worthy of it, or is it fated to live in slavery? That is the vital question in the present catastrophe, and all the democracies have given their answer. There is no question of the retreat or compromise in a war in which the opposing principles are so clearly and distinctly defined. No one could hesitate to do his duty. Not to defend our country would be to surrender the Republic. Our country and our Republic. Socialism and the spirit of revolution, these are inseparably bound together. If the Treaty of Versailles was the work of Masonry, it was also a great Jewish victory. The principle of European monarchies had been overthrown. The hated Tsarist regime had been swept away, and all the members of the imperial family who were in Russia at the time had been savagely massacred. Russia had been bled white, bound hand and foot, and delivered to the Bolsheviks, whose principal leaders, apart from Lenin, who, however, was born of a Russian father and a Jewish mother, and Stalin were at the time Jewish. Revolution raged throughout Europe, and without exception, all the leaders were Jews. Finally, the Jews had achieved their supreme conquest, Palestine. As Leon Mutskin, president of the Committee of Jewish Delegations, stated in an article entitled "The Jewish Minority and the League of Nations," which appeared in this magazine that I can't pronounce its name. At Versailles, everything had been minutely prepared and nothing had been left to chance. That was a moment of triumph savored in silence. The leaders of the three big powers at Versailles, Wilson, Clemenceau, and Lloyd George, were surrounded by Jewish advisors, like all our congressmen and senators here in the United States. That's a real plum for them to get become the advisors of our so-called leaders. The leaders of the three big powers at Versailles, well, I read that. The preponderance of Jewish influence in the course of the debates made a profound impression on certain observers, and their opinion has been summed up by the English writer E.J. Dillon. Quote, "It may seem amazing to some readers, but it is nonetheless a fact that a considerable number of delegates believe that the real influence behind the Anglo-Saxon peoples were Semitic. They concluded that the sequence of expedients framed and enforced in this direction were inspired by the Jews, assembled in Paris for the purpose of realizing their carefully sought-out program, which they succeeded in having substantially executed. The formula into which this policy was thrown by members of the conference, whose countries it affected, and who regarded it as a fatal to the peace of Eastern Europe, was this. Quote, "Hence the world will be governed by the Anglo-Saxon peoples, who in turn are swayed by their Jewish elements." That's a very important thing, and that's what's been going on for hundreds of years. Yeah, the Anglo-Saxons have controlled much of the world, but the Jews guided them the way they wanted them to go. And it's really come to a head in this country. Such was their success that Moltzkin wrote in a work glorifying the Jews, quote, "Despite appalling pogroms which broke out first of all in Poland and then in unheard proportions in the Ukraine, claiming the lives of tens of thousands of our people, Jewish people, considered the post-war period as a messianic era. In these years of 1919 to 1920, Israel clamored for joy in the Central and Eastern Europe, and even more so in America. But the era of messianic triumph was not to last for long. The streak of fatalism which has dogged the Jewish people throughout their long history struck again, bringing to naught the tenacious and persevering efforts of a century past. First of all in Russia, and then Germany. In Russia, on Lenin's death, it looked as if Trotsky was his successor designate. But suddenly, and most unexpectedly, a man appeared in his path, Stalin. The latter had only played a minor role in the October Revolution, and nobody at that time would have accorded him much chance beside the big Bolshevik leaders whose names were glorified in revolutionary annals. Nevertheless, the struggle shortly resolved into a duel to the death between two giants who were perfectly well aware that neither would show the other any mercy. It was a fight between Trotsky's concept of permanent revolution and Stalin's idea of socialism in one country. Trotsky, an international Jew, the demonical spirit of world revolution, was set against Stalin, cold, pitiless, secret, the man of steel who had escaped six times from Siberia, the Asiatic, the terrorist of Tiflis. Against all expectations, Stalin emerged the victor. Trotsky went into exile in Turkey, France, Norway, and Mexico, where he was finally assassinated. For Stalin's implacable hatred never forgave and never forget. With the loss of their leader, all the communist Jews of the old Bolshevik Guard were eliminated, and more restrictive measures were taken against the Jewish population, which was eliminated from the positions of command and influence. Today in Soviet Russia, the Jews endure an even more severe regime and have even less power than under the Tsars, a strange and fantastic twist in the nemesis of history. This initial catastrophe was soon followed by another, which was more swift, more brutal, and more serious. In Germany, between 1918 and 1934, the Jews were politically, economically, financially, and intellectually the masters of Germany, which they had led into a state of chaos and total decomposition. But suddenly, there sprang up from nowhere a totally unknown individual who was to exercise an almost hypnotic fascination on the people. It was an almost unprecedented case in history. In 1933, Hitler became chancellor and virtually the sole master of Germany, a master whom the whole world obeyed with blind confidence. After a series of unheard-of triumphs, he finally led Germany to an appalling disaster, a somber and bloody twilight of the gods. Quote, in late July 1933, an international Jewish boycott conference in New York was held in Amsterdam to devise means of bringing Germany to terms. Samuel Untermeyer of New York presided over the conference and was elected president of the World Jewish Economic Federation. Returning to America, Mr. Untermeyer described the planned Jewish move against Germany as a holy war, a war that must be waged unremittingly. That was from the New York Times in 1933. The immediately feasible tactic of the economic boycott was described by Mr. Untermeyer as nothing new for President Roosevelt, whose wise statesmanship and vision are the wonders of the civilized world, is invoked it in furtherance of his noble conception of the relations between capital and labor. Mr. Untermeyer gave his hearers and readers specific instructions. As it may be seen, it is a veritable declaration of war on the part of international Judaism, supported by Roosevelt's administration in America against Germany. As from this moment, the Jews of the entire world undertook a campaign without respite to stir up the war against Hitler. The German Jewish writer Emil Ludwig, who had prudently fled to Switzerland, set himself up as a spokesman for Jewry by the publication of a work which was launched with a great deal of to-do, entitled A New Holy Alliance, in which he urged the conclusion of a new holy alliance between the three great democracies of the world. Quote, the foundations of a new holy alliance are neither Christian nor royal, and neither of the three founders of the former have any share in this one, for its principles are different, following the philosophy of the times. The influence of the United States in this alliance will be the decisive factor, because this new alliance is first and foremost designed as a threat and a deterrent, and a chief role falls to America. Roosevelt is watching. Since he has come to power, he has made five major speeches which show that the United States stands with the democracies in the struggle against the dictators. All countries may join the new holy alliance among the great powers. The Soviet Union will be the first. The national philosophy will decide whether or not a state is to be admitted into the alliance. The alliance is directed against Germany, Italy, and similar states which might adopt such principles at any moment. It issues its challenge in even more forceful language than that of the dictators. The political aims of the century are socialism as the national expedient, and the United States of Europe as the international policy. Is it possible to reach both goals without war? It seems hardly likely that Ludwig makes no attempt to disguise the fact, since he concludes his appeal with these words. Religions, philosophies, ideals have always been formulated and guarded by solitary thinkers, but they have always been defended by armed men at peril of their lives. France's role in this campaign of provocation to war has been admirably depicted by the former deputy J. Montigny, who played an influential role in French politics and who was closely involved in all these events. Quote, as the peril increased, people gradually became aware that there was a conspiracy to provoke a war in which up to then they had refused to believe. My grandmother used to tell me, war is a Jew harvest. And that was when I was a little kid. At the Congress of Royan, the most diverse and opposing points of view met head on. Both militant intellectuals and those who were traditionally loyal to peaceful ideas were dumbfounded at Blum's volt face and began to discern in him an apostle of a new war of religion. The policy of force against fascism was defended by his best friends, such as Szymanski, Rosenfeld, and Louis Levy. But the deputy of the Haveder retorted that in reality they were paying the cost of the absurd Treaty of Versailles, which had balkanized Europe. Why could not the treaty be revised? Quote, this was indeed to beg the question as to whether another war would have to be fought in order at all costs to uphold the defects of the Treaty of Versailles. Hitler, however, was preparing to invade Central Europe. On 5th November 37, he held a meeting of his chiefs of staff and some ministers. His plan, as noted by his aide-de-camp, and which was later found by the Allies and published after the war was to seek the room that Germany needed for expansion in the East. The Ukraine, beginning with the annexation of Austria and Czechoslovakia, no date had been fixed, but everything was to be done to increase military strength. The Führer also hoped that in France and Great Britain's present state of weakness, this plan could be achieved without embarking upon a war. He was not concerned about Italy, for he had laid on a magnificent reception for Mussolini in September, and on the 6th of November the Duce signed the Anti-Comintern Pact, which Germany had ratified with Japan in the previous year. Quote, such was Hitler's plan for the East, and which henceforth is the Siegfried line revealed on the ground, comprised no further preliminary action against France. Considering the state of military inferiority to which our country had sunk, and that we would be unlikely to conclude a rapid alliance with any power, the delay which this plan afforded France was a gift from heaven. But the war party, which had decided the rules once and for all, had other ideas in their scheme of things. France was to be in the avant-garde, supported rather tardily by England, and America was to be in the rear. In order to convince France that she had to shoulder this tearful task, she had to be deceived, and the truth was hidden from her. Political refugees from Germany and Italy were employed in this work. Heinrich Mann, for example, wrote an article in an important paper which he stated, Germans who want to save civilization have no other choice. Hitler must go. Paul Reynaud, speaking in the chamber, told the nation that not only was France strong in herself, but that the British were undertaking a gigantic rearmament, and behind the gigantic British rearmament is another one, which, believe me, will be the be a council of the wisdom of the dictators, and that is the colossal rearmament of the United States. But as if this was not enough, another argument was deployed to reassure the French. They were told that they would hardly have to fight, since Hitler would collapse of his own accord. This is what Thomas Mann actually stated in a letter published in the issue of June 19, 1937, of Droit Revue, the organ of the International League Against Anti-Semitism. There is no people in the world, quote, there is no people in the world today less in a position to wage war than the Germans. They would have no allies. Furthermore, the majority of the people are in a state of revolt. After the first defeat, the struggle would turn into a civil war. No, this war is impossible. Germany cannot wage it. Hence, continues Montague, arose the conviction, which was sustained until the fatal day, of the so-called Hitler bluff. D'Alierde was won over to the crusade of the democracies by prudently considering that it would be unwise for France to step into the front ranks of the firing line until she could be sure that Great Britain would be following behind her, whereas Blum, Renaud, and Mandel wanted to get the thing off the ground as soon as possible, since the Anglo-Saxon would be forced to follow suit. In August 1938, Bonnet, Minister of Foreign Affairs, was entertained by Bordeaux, and at dinner, Mandel, who was the deputy of the department, sat next to the president of the Court of Appeal. After the meal, the magistrate went up to Bonnet and said, "Mr. Mandel has just told me that there has got to be a war, and the sooner the better." Mr. Bonnet recalled that France was in a low state of military strength. "I know that," replied Mandel, "but the democracies only prepare for war after they have declared the war. Therefore, we should begin them." His plan was implacable, but logical. He and his friends were indeed well aware that France would have a hard fight following a declaration of war, that she would lose many men and might even provincially be conquered. At the worst, she would be invaded, but she has an empire. Her army might have to capitulate, but the government could emigrate and continue the struggle from Africa. And later, after final victory, France could be resuscitated with the whatever remained of the French. Such was the plan which had been thought out by Mandel, the brains behind Renaud, and in 1940 supported by Libram, Ginemi, and Herat. They did in fact urge the government to emigrate. This step, however, was opposed by Pétain and Weygand, and parliamentary lobbies behind them. Quote, "This plan may seem inhuman, but it was logical, whereas D'Alierre's view was unrealistic. There could be no compromise between Mandel's policy and the latter's." Finally, in September 1939, Germany attacked Poland, whereupon England, followed by France, declared war with a criminal lack of consideration, for both countries were totally unprepared. They were to be rudely awoken. In less than 3 weeks, Poland had been invaded and crushed. Soviet Russia, whose alliance had been considered militarily as indefensible, did a spectacular about-turn and signed a pact with Germany, and meanwhile, it rapidly became evident that the British Army needed a long period of preparation before it would be able to make any effective intervention. and the United States ostensibly refused to enter the war on the side of France. France, in a word, found herself in a very tight spot, and her state of military unpreparedness caused a profound stupefaction among her people, who had been told that their army was the best in the world. In this position, and in order to prevent public opinion and Parliament from considering fresh overtures for peace, Mandel and his friends realized that they would have to stir up the war at all costs, in every direction, no matter what risks were involved. To the general astonishment, having overrun Poland, Hitler then offered to make peace, and made no demands upon the West except that he should be left free to act as he chose in the East. D'Alier hesitated, but at this moment the war party, animated by Mandel, stepped in. Quote, "The President D'Alier received exhortations designed to bring him into line. Mandel and Renaud and their friends stood guard over the President and brought formidable pressure to bear upon him. Provisionally, they succeeded in stiffening his morale and in getting him back into line. Thus it was, as Montaigne tells us, that a secret brain trust decided France's policy at a moment of supreme gravity for the nation, and imposed its will upon the President, who in consequences refused to receive the offers of peace. But D'Alier and Chamberlain were dreamers who might suffer a relapse, and accordingly Mandel told his friend General Spears early in 1940 that the English should take command of the war, and since this role is apparently beyond Chamberlain, and sooner Churchill is in power, the better. At the same time, Mandel was working to bring about D'Alier's fall and Renaud's rise to power, as the former ministry Lemery relates. Quote, "At the end of February, at the beginning of March 1940, Maurice de Rothschild invited me out to lunch outside Paris. He told me that Mandel would call and collect me. Paul Renaud was present, and in the afternoon we discussed the political situation. Mandel made the point in his habitual peremptory manner that the war was languishing, the country was becoming discouraged, and that we would have to get out of the stagnation into which D'Alier had relapsed and hand over power to Renaud. I was asked about the Senate would do were this happen. I replied that it would accept a ministry of public safety comprising only of a few ministers. If such a ministry could command a majority in the chamber, a few days later, after this conversation was continued, this time at Maurice de Rothschild's house in Paris, and Mr. Duff Cooper was there. Again, the conversation turned to the question of replacing D'Alier and Renaud, and of entering into a pact with the London government in order to affirm their joint determination to pursue the war to total victory. Quote, "These two factors sought by Mandel were soon to be accomplished both in Paris and in London." In Paris, Renaud was elected Prime Minister by a majority vote. Several weeks later, in the middle of June, the Allied armies had been pierced at Sedan, cut from through at Abbeville, surrounded at Lille and Dunkirk, and defeated in Artois and Picardy. Their front had been broken in Champagne. The armies of Lorraine and Alsace and the Maginot Line could no longer escape being encircled. The public administration left Paris, and 3 million French, Dutch, and Belgian refugees had flooded out onto our roads, holding up military convoys. Suddenly stripped of her defenses, France fell into anarchy. At the meeting of the ministers outside Tours, General-in-Chief Wagon, supported by Marshal Petain, declared that the army should choose between capitulation and an armistice, and that since the former course was contrary to honor and forbidden by the military code, conditions for an eventual armistice should be demanded from the enemy, provided that it was understood that they would only be accepted if they were honorable and would safeguard the freedom of our fleet and our possessions overseas. The Council of Ministers were overwhelmed at being put on notice that they should study the conditions of an armistice, for the Franco-British agreement forbade separate armistices. This meant that the situation would have to be laid before Churchill in order to obtain his assent to eventually of such an armistice. The council decided to invite the British Prime Minister to attend a conference with them. On the following day, the president of the council was charged with transmitting this invitation. As he explained at the trial of Marshal Petain, Paul Renaud decided to see Churchill first of all alone and not to tell him about the council's invitation. He would only bring him to the conference when he had assured himself of his refusal. Quote, however, on the following day, Churchill, aware of the insufficient British contribution to the defense of France, and stirred by the situation of our country, withdrew all opposition, and after consulting with the ministers who had accompanied him, soon confirmed that he was well disposed towards this proposal. The separate armistice became the least disastrous course for France to adopt, but it was contrary to the plans for the crusade. Furthermore, it would deprive the conspiring war party in France of the dramatic departure they envisioned with a well-orchestrated hero's farewell upon embarkation for overseas. For if they were to remain in France, they would have to take action, and if they fled privately, their political careers would be compromised. The counterattack rapidly developed. First of all, Churchill was allowed to leave without being told that the Council of Ministers were waiting for them, and subsequently the Council was informed that the Prime Minister had refused to agree to a separate armistice. Finally, a well-trusted messenger was sent to London to inform him of the falsehood and to ask him to retract his previous consent, which had been kept secret. It was General de Gaulle, Reynald's confidant, who was chosen to accomplish this mission. Towards the end of the afternoon, the Council of Ministers, deceived by their president, his false report, decided to postpone and demand for an armistice. Mandel was happy and told General Spears how the consul had been tricked. At Bordeaux, Renaud resigned, and the former Minister of Interior set out for Morocco on a steamer, Malaysia. During the trip, he learned with surprise that the armistice had been signed. He told his friends that when he arrived in Morocco, he would try to set up a government in order to continued the war in North Africa with the French fleet. As soon as he had disembarked, he went to the British Embassy, where, following a conversation, Churchill was notified by the situation, immediately summoned a cabinet meeting, and decided to send out a minister and a top military authority to Casablanca at once, with instructions to help Mandel in his rebellion. But the wheel of fortune had turned. General Nogues, who was a resident in Morocco and who was commander-in-chief of North Africa, decided to remain faithful to Marshal Petain. But Mandel, back on Marsala, and dismissed Churchill's envoys. The latter event proves Mandel's preeminent position in the conspiracy. A year earlier, Chamberlain had remarked that the war is not a speculation with money, but with human beings, and it is impossible to calculate the disasters that would result from a conflict. Since then, he has been overwhelmed by the warlike declarations which have assailed him from all sides, and he resigned himself to the war from the day when ideological passions managed to silence the voice of reason. Daladier was in tow with these were his thoughts as he confessed to a paramilitary commission of inquiry. The French government threw itself into war in desperation, thinking of the ruin that would be caused. It was convinced that France would only be at the avant-garde of a coalition army, that the war would last a long time and their catastrophe would follow catastrophe. And he ended with William II's cry, "I didn't want it." He did not want it, but he did it, and he did it because he was maneuvered by the Crusaders. He often telephoned Roosevelt from the United States Embassy in Paris, and we have very weighty evidence as of President's disposition at this time from the person of Mr. Joseph Kennedy, the father of the late President Kennedy. At that time, Joseph Kennedy was Roosevelt's ambassador to Great Britain and on friendly terms with the president. And in 1945, he held a conversation with Mr. Forrestal, then a member of the American government, which was so serious that the latter wrote it down in his diary when he returned to his house. This diary was published after the war, and here is the passage in question. December 45. Played golf today with Joseph Kennedy. Kennedy's view was that Hitler would have fought Russia without any later conflict with England if it had not been for the Blitz ambassador to France, urging on Roosevelt in the summer of 1939 that the Germans must be faced down about Poland. Neither the French nor the British would have made Poland a case of war if it had not been for the constant needling from Washington. Bullitt, he said, kept telling Roosevelt that the Germans wouldn't fight. Kennedy said that they would, and that they would overrun Europe. Chamberlain, he says, stated that America and the world Jews have forced England into the war. In his telephone conversations with Roosevelt in the summer of 39, the president kept telling him to put some iron up Chamberlain's backside. That's from the Forrestal diaries. Forrestal was a Secretary of State, I believe. He had a very strange death. He was at the Bethesda Naval Hospital for some kind of physical problem, and he ended up, they say, committing suicide out of the top of the building several floors high. Many people think he was pushed. Chamberlain's opinion on the importance of Jewish pressure being brought to bear in favor of the war in the United States is confirmed by a report from Count Potocki, Polish ambassador in Washington, who warned his government in 1939 of the campaign that was being organized in response to recent anti-Semitic excesses of the Nazis, a campaign in which various Jewish intellectuals took part, such as Bernard Baruch Frankfurter, a justice of the Supreme Court, Morgenthau, Secretary of Treasury. Morgenthau was the one who advocated totally bringing Germany to its total knees, turning it into a farming society, destroying everything. And there was some talk of cutting the balls off the men. I mean, that's really wild, but there was that kind of talk going on. And it was from this Jew that was living in the White House. This group of men who held some of the highest posts in the American government was very closely connected to international Jewry. Will Count Pataki be accused of anti-Semitism? The Jewish writer Emanuel Berl wrote before the Munich crisis, quote, all the Jews in politics hope for war and are urging towards it. Daily proof of this attitude is to be found in the corridors of the chamber, not to mention Bloom and Mandel's example. The Jewish community as a political unit has been and still is the life and soul of the war party. Nothing has changed. This indeed is one of the truths of that time, but that it is not to implicate the majority of Jews, but only well-organized international minority whose power lay in their wealth, their determination, and in the key positions which they held in the democratic world. However, I say that the bulk of the other Jews follow in their wake and don't resist their crimes. So we can't let the general Jewish population off the hook totally, except once in a while there's one Jew that'll get out of his traces and attack these criminals at the top. And they go after them and even have them killed. There is also another point to be considered. The war leaders and statesmen of St. Petersburg, Vienna, Berlin, Paris, who in 1914 yielded with varying degrees of responsibility to the temptation to hold a trial of strength, they had an excuse. They all believed that it would be a short war. In fact, no other alternative was even admitted. That reminds me of this last election. Everybody thought it was a cakewalk. No problem. Hillary's got it made. They got fooled. Quote, Hitler had the same hope in 1939 for a short war. Stalin, on the other hand, was gambling on a long war of attrition, which the leaders of the democracies and their military experts knew was inevitable. This is confirmed by Ambassador Bullitt's proposals to Count Pataki in November 1938, which were reported to the Polish government in the following terms. According to the information which the military experts supplied to Bullitt at the time of the crisis in autumn of 1938, a war would last at least 6 months and would end with a complete disaster for Europe. There was no doubt whatever that the end Soviet Russia was to profit by it all. The United States was to benefit by it as well. It would be a mistake to imagine Roosevelt was simply an idealist. Certain remarks he made to his son Elliot reveal that he was capable of realistic egotism. In the summer of 1941, some months before Pearl Harbor, Roosevelt, who had been reelected in 1940, still refused Churchill's plea that he should enter the war. He explained his tactics to his son by drawing a comparison with a game of football. For the moment, he said, we are the reserve players sitting it out on the bench, and it is the Russians who have had the field. Our role is to follow the game, and before our markers, England and Russia, get tired, to join in for the final trial. In this way, we will come to the struggle all fresh. Thus, in contrast to the French leaders who were so eager to throw their country into a fight at the very start, Roosevelt, in the same way, and Stalin had sought to intervene in the war as late as possible, when all the others would be exhausted. I can imagine this type of thinking. By exhausted, thousands, maybe millions of men, soldiers, dead. And what they're talking about, waiting them out until they're exhausted. Maybe until every one of their soldiers are dead. At the same time, he did not hide from Churchill the prizes on which his eyes were fixed, the abolition of imperial tariffs and a general move towards decolonization, which he hoped would greatly enrich his own country commercially. Thus, in 1942, at the Casablanca Conference, he held out to the Sultan of Morocco, who took it, the bait of independence matched by future economic relations between the two countries. Be that it as may, France, who declared war for fear of having forced upon her one day, carried it on for fear she should be recommence it, and thus courted disaster for fear of a future defeat. Incidentally, a staggering fact emerges from Montigny's book, as the following episode relates. Quote, at this period, De Manzi, the Minister of Public Works, made a short trip to London, and all his time was taken up with conferences with his opposite number in England. A few days after he had returned, he received a pressing invitation to dine with one of the clan of the Rothschilds in London. During the dessert, this lady said to him, quote, I believe that you have just returned from London, Minister. Yes, he replied. Do you realize that you have been regretfully neglectful? You are aware of the importance of the head of our family there, and you never went to see him? Talking about the Rothschild family. I'm sorry that I wasn't able to do so, but I was too busy during my short stay. And yet Paul Renaud, who is just as busy as you are when he is in London, never fails to visit the Rothschild family. I had been invited to give this lesson. De Manzi concluded that therefore I had no more illusions. Dadelier's heir presumptive had already been chosen, and it was due course Lieben would be notified. In other words, at the height of the war, London Rothschilds were able to decide the choice of French Prime Minister. Such an incredible piece of information goes without comment. 3 years earlier, Montigny had admirably depicted the atmosphere of a war of religion, which was to impregnate the Second World War, in a speech at the chamber in 1936. Quote, our foreign policy, he stated, was succeeding in creating two opposing power blocks in Europe. The serious thing is that these two blocks not merely represent political and economic combinations. More and more it is emerging that the struggle is between political doctrines, social systems, and philosophical conceptions, and their mutual antagonisms has only been increased by the case of Ethiopia, the Spanish and French elections, and the Spanish Civil War. The conflict, which rises with ever-increasing passion, is between the ideas of collective security and bilateral agreements, racism and internationalism, Hitlerism and communism, and finally between fascism and democracy. From this point of view, the situation in Europe is worse than in 1913 because it's no longer a case, as it was then, simply of opposing blocs. We are confronted with self-excommunicating ideas. The other side is not merely regarded as a rival or an adversary. He is a heretic whose criminal face should be destroyed. Europe is permeated with the atmosphere of a war of religion, which is endangered by the spirit of a crusade. How else could one explain certain sudden changes which have come about? Those circles which formerly most ardently sought peace today unhesitatingly demand war, a war effort and human sacrifice as soon as it is in question of supporting what in their eyes is a holy war, holy cause, be it yesterday against Italian fascism, or today against Spanish fascism, or tomorrow against Hitlerian heresy. The moment that it is allowed to become patriotic, the most anti-military party immediately exalts the army with unprecedented furor. That is where Europe has got to. After two centuries of struggle towards reason and progress, and the tragedy is that this progress has placed an unlimited power of massacre at the service of passions which belong to the Middle Ages. You might wonder why the Masons are mentioned quite a bit in here. Well, the Masons have always been up to their necks in all this kind of stuff. And Albert Pike, of course, was a powerful Mason in this country. He was a member of the Golden Circle and supported the South, actually. And he declared that no black man would ever be a Mason. In his big book, the Mason's Bible, it's about 500-600 pages. I've got one here. It says in there at some point, I used to remember the page numbers, all the secret signs and symbols of Masonry comes from the Kabbalah. And of course the Kabbalah is Jewish mysticism. So anybody says that there's no connection between the Jews and the Masons are nuts. Plus the fact that you can go to any Mason's hall in this country and find Jews' pictures on the wall. In fact, in downtown L.A. in the Mexican area, and they have the original Masonic Hall that was in Los Angeles. And you can go in there and see all the Grand Masters of the group on the wall. And you'll see several Jewish Grand Masters of the group on the wall. So don't let anybody ever tell you that there's a separation between the Jews and the Masons. One interesting thing I can tell you about, when I was in Japan, and I was taken to Japan by friendly Japanese to our racial position, plus I met with National Socialist Japanese while I was there. Yes, there are National Socialist Japanese. Of course, you know, a lot of the Japanese don't look upon Hitler as a bad guy like they do every place else. Anyhow, there's a big tower in the city on top of a mountain. Not a great big mountain like Suribachi, but a mountain. And that tower, you can go up for about 300-400 feet in an elevator over the city of Tokyo. And of course, you can see forever. Well, I noticed when I came down that at the bottom there was a Masonic hall that MacArthur brought Masonry to Japan, of course, General MacArthur. Well, anyhow, I went in the door, being the inquisitive guy I am. I saw nobody there as a receptionist or anything else, and so I just started looking around. And I got in an elevator and went down. Now, this elevator goes down for hundreds of feet in that mountain. Finally, I came into the main hall way down at the bottom with the giant seeing eye, which all Masonic lodges have, or most of them, I'm sure. And it's pretty creepy. There was no one ever came out of any door or anything to challenge me or ask me what I wanted. It was almost like they knew exactly who I was and exactly why I was looking around and approved of it or something. I don't know. It's strange to me. But I never saw one person after going down 4 or 5 levels into the ground in an elevator into the main hall of the group and their big all-seeing eye on the ceiling giant all-seeing eye coming back up, and no one ever approached me. I never saw one living person. That was a strange thing. I still trying to figure that one out. When I was there, of course, I've mentioned this before, that the person who took me to Japan from California knew a lot of people in high places, and we met with a lot of people in high places. In fact, he introduced me to the head of the Japanese equivalent to our CIA, and I had breakfast with him and my friend. Very pleasant person. They treated me wonderfully in Japan, and had a lot of, a lot of sympathy with what we're talking about race. In fact, at one point I addressed about 500 military, political, business leaders of Japan in a big hall, which it never came out in the American press, all this stuff. And my enemies never attacked me for doing things like that, but they, you know, attacked me for being just a TV man. So anyhow, and I met with people from the emperor's household and had dinner with a bunch of these big shots one night, including top military people and top police officials and so forth. And when I left, I was met at the airport by the chief of police of Tokyo. He presented me with a couple of gifts and was extremely nice to me, and I left. So that's part of a story that hasn't been told much. And, you know, you can get a guy like Plastic Man that happens to go skiing someplace, or he spends money down on the Mississippi gambling, and they write about it all day, or the fact that he's supposedly supporting Donald Trump. But these kind of things that I felt were very important, because I spoke about there, the Japanese could not trust the United States government and all these people. I said, you can't trust them. They liked my opinion because I was more just a working class guy. And I said, watch out. Watch out when you're dealing with Washington. And I think they're beginning to understand now that the United States has built China into this superpower. Yeah. And I, when I was there is when the Chinese tested that rocket. That rocket went across the Japanese sea and it was headed towards Tokyo. So they tended to believe some of the things I was telling them. One thing I told them to do is, you better rearm, because you're going to probably have to fight one of these days. Very possibly, China will try to take Japan one of these days, someday in the future. Might not be right away, but one of these days. I hope you can see when the stuff I'm reading you will show clearly that people of our race, powerful people of our race, have been lockstep with the Jews for a long, long time, way back to under the kings. So when right-wing racial groups, and I know like the Dukites and so forth, spend all their time attacking the Jews, but they never bring it, they hardly ever bring it out that the people, big shots of the white race, are up to their neck in it and being led around by the nose by the Jews. You can't attack one without attacking the other. And that's why the conservatives don't get any place, because they don't represent the white working class. They try to throw them a bone once in a while, but they really don't. And the Democrats, Jewish left, has conned the white working class and used them very effectively, again in service of the Jews. I'll be back on Moon's Day, and remember, in the meantime, I have nothing to say. I want a lawyer, baby.